What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion. This is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Yes, indeed, a program specifically on Catholic radio for non-Catholics. If you are not a Catholic yourself, maybe you were a Catholic as a kid, stepped away from the church for whatever reason, or maybe you stepped away as an adult for some reason, or you've never been a Catholic. But now, here we are in 2019, and you've got some questions about the Catholic faith, because maybe you're thinking about rejoining the faith of your youth or the faith that you hear so much about. Here is our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. You can also text the letters EWTN to 55000. Wait for our response, and then text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. For those of you watching on television today, you can participate as well. Our email address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Lines are open right now, waiting to hear from you. Charles Beery is our producer. We also have Ryan Penny as our phone screener and Jeff Burson on social media. He'll be glad to pass on any questions that you might want to pose via YouTube or Facebook. We are live streaming on those platforms right now. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
Very, very well. And you, my friend?
You know, I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Glad to hear that. We've got some great emails to lead off with here. Here's one from Charlie. We read that Moses pleads for the people, and then God relents. Well, if God is all-knowing and is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow, how can God change his mind?
God doesn't change his mind. God plans from all eternity to effect his plan of salvation, relying upon the instrumentality of human prayer.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So prayer actually works. Prayer is an instrumental cause that God uses to bring about his purposes, but he has planned from the beginning, ordained from the beginning, that part of his purpose is to unfold salvation using human mediation, including intercession. And okay. So, you know, with respect to us, it appears to us that God changes, or that because, you know, you're in condition A, you pray, all of a sudden you're in condition B, right? But from God's point of view in eternity, he sees reality as a single permanent instant in which our change of position relative to him and his grace and our prayers is part of this single divine instant of the unfolding of his purposes.
Okay. Very good. And Charlie, thank you so much for your email. Here's one now from Nathan checking in from the UK. He says, if the Catholic Church is the one true church, which I believe it is, why do we not show the same zeal as the Jehovah's Witnesses do and go to door to bring people to the truth?
Okay, thanks. I really appreciate the question. Like it's packed into that question, one of them is kind of a presumption that the way to go about doing evangelism is to go to door the way that Jehovah's Witnesses do. I think that's a presumption that's worthy of critique, perhaps. Maybe that's not exactly accurate.
All right.
Do you want to see zeal in the Catholic faith? All I have to do is look at the saints. You'll find all the zeal you need.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them were the kind that went door-to-door in pursuit of converts. I think of St. Francis de Sales, who was the Bishop of Geneva in the 17th century, but could never visit his episcopal see because it was in the hands of Calvinists, and they would have run him out on a rail if he tried to go in. So he stayed in the Duchy of Savoy, the Duchy of Savoy, attached outside, and was protected there by a Catholic aristocrat. And there were a number of Calvinists that had kind of bled over into Savoy from Geneva, but he couldn't talk to them openly. And again, they would kind of throw stones and sticks at him and so forth if he tried to engage. So what he did instead is he wrote tracts. And he would go out at night and he would slip them under the doors of all the Calvinists. And he brought tens of thousands of people back to the Catholic faith through that means. Those tracts have actually been collected into a little book published by TAN Publishers under the title Catholic Controversy, The Catholic Controversy by St. Francis de Sales. So there he is, going out door to door at night, sliding tracts under the doors.
Wow.
But, you know, there's different kinds of zeal, different ways of exhibiting the truth of the Catholic faith. I think of Mother Teresa of Calcutta as a good example. She was very keen, actually, on not proselytizing. I mean, it was a big part of her spirituality and identity that she was not doing what she did to serve the poor in India because she was seeking proselytes, but because she was seeking Christ. And nor was she a social worker. You know, she would get upset when people said she was engaged in social work. She said, no, I'm not engaged in social work. I am a religious. I am a religious. I am a religious. I'm not seeking converts. I'm seeking Christ in the face of the poor. And did people convert because of the zeal of Mother Teresa? You bet.
Oh, yeah.
But her mode of expression was different from your Jehovah's Witness friends who are actually trying to actively convert you through proselytizing. You know, you look at a John Bosco. You look at a Blessed Giorgio Frassati. I mean, you could come up. All of them express their zeal for the faith according to their own particular charism. Let me end with Francis of Assisi. You will not find greater zeal. You will not find greater zeal in the history of Christianity, of any tradition, than you will find in the life of Francis of Assisi. He was not real big on, like, direct proselytism in the way that you're discussing.
Mm-hmm.
His one attempt at proselytism was kind of abortive. He actually went to Egypt and tried to convert the Sultan down there.
Oh, yeah.
And he said, I'll tell you what we'll do. You line up your mullahs, and I'll line up, and we'll all walk into the fire and see who comes out unscathed. And they couldn't get anybody to try the other side. You know, he couldn't get any takers on that plan.
Sure.
And he went home. They kind of patted him on the head, thought he was a cute little Franciscan, and sent him on back to Europe, you know. And so he ended in frustration. Has Francis of Assisi ever won any converts through his holiness of life? You're not going to find greater zeal.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, he was so zealous. At first, the Pope was like, I'm not going to let you do this. This is too hardcore. You can't be that good a Christian. It's not possible. And he said, try me.
Yeah.
And they said, okay. And then you know what happened.
And by the way, there are groups that do go door to door. We're thinking here of the Parish Visitors of Mary Immaculate, also famously the Legion of Mary.
Yep.
Yeah, quite a few. So it is being done. So anyway, thank you so much for your email. In a moment here, we'll get to Paul in Dayton, Ohio. We have a line open for you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's Call to Communion here on EWTN, the Global Catholic Radio Network. Do stay with us. It's EWTN's Call to Communion. Glad that you're with us today. And if you're ready, let's get to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. We begin with Paul in Dayton, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio, AM 820. Hello, Paul. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I heard your invitation to call in if, you know, you're either a new Catholic or have been in the Catholic Church in a way or whatever. And I'm kind of actually on the brink of that right now.
Okay.
In a stage to where I feel like I'm walking away from the church. And the reason is I feel like my faith is stronger than ever. I've been in a catechist for the past 14 years for the confirmation year, but I feel like I can't be an advocate for the church these days. The church is becoming just completely too liberal for me and not embracing conservative values that I feel like I grew up with. Especially along things of sanctity of life, kind of embracing homosexualism. And then also, just recently, with the Pope having taken $500,000, which is more than I'll ever tithe in my life, and just giving away for a day's worth of food for the caravans, pushing it up against our border. I feel like he's opposing, you know, the policies and the politics of the United States and exacerbating a situation.
Okay,
thanks. I'd like to speak to that if I could. So a couple of questions. First of all, do you think you would have had a hard time being Catholic in the 4th century when St. Athanasius was exiled multiple times for holding to the Orthodox faith of the Trinity and the Nicene Creed, and the Pope seemed to be silent? Or you think about Pope Liberius, who had an opportunity to stand up and defend the truth of the dogma of the Trinity. Instead, he was a temporizer who tried to mollify all sides. Or what about during the Monothelite controversy, when Honorius, Pope Honorius, seemed, by all accounts, to be openly supporting the heresy of monothelitism. Whether he did or he didn't actually hold that heresy, contemporaries thought he was giving cover to what was, you know, a position that was definitely heretical and ruled as such by the councils of the Church. Or Pope John the 22nd, one of the Avignon popes who lived in luxury and decadence in Avignon, and was, seems to be, a material heretic on the doctrine of the beatific vision, and had to be corrected by practically everybody, the theologians at Paris and the other bishops. And he eventually came around on that and did us the favor of canonizing Thomas Aquinas. But he had kind of a rough period. Or what about the 16th century when Julius II was leading the armies of the Papal States into vicious combat to advance the material dominions of his empire? I think it might have been tough to be Catholic at any of these times when some of the shepherds of the Church were giving mixed signals about where their commitments lay. And yet, you know, there were writers like Erasmus of Rotterdam, the Renaissance scholar and satirist, who wrote the brilliant satire of Julius II, called Julius Excluded, that depicts Pope Julius showing up at the gates of heaven and Peter refusing to let him in. And the two of them engage. This is fiction, of course. Sure. They have a dialogue about whether Julius should come into heaven. Julius is sitting there laying out all his accomplishments. And every one of them are like, you know, levying taxes and beating back the French and, you know, and this kind of business. And who are you, Peter? You were just a fisherman. You didn't do anything for the Papal States, you know. And, of course, Peter doesn't let him in. And Julius goes off in a huff and says he's going to go raise an army, you know, come back and storm the gates.
Okay.
Did Erasmus falter? I mean, like, he's the one writing the satire, right? He had every opportunity in the world to join the Lutherans, but he was Luther's staunchest critic. Luther said of Erasmus that he alone, of all his critics, had hit the nail on the head and found the heart of Luther's doctrine and went after the heart, which was the question of whether we can cooperate with God's grace. And Erasmus said yes. He held for the free will of man, and Luther, of course, said no, held for the bondage of the will.
Mm-hmm.
So my point in these illustrations is that, like, Catholic identity and my devotion to the Church, my belief in the Church, has never, ever, in the whole history of the Church, been about fidelity to the person of the Pope or the Bishop or the priest. It's never been about that. And in any era, it's someone is always going to disagree, and perhaps vehemently, with the actual policy decisions of the Pope or his own bishop. And that's true of Pope Francis. It was true of Pope Benedict. It was true of Pope John Paul II.
Sure.
It was true of Paul VI. It's true of John the 22nd. True of Pius the 12th. You keep going. You're not going to find a pope in the history of the Church that didn't have vehement detractors that thought that his policies were positively evil. And defenders. That's the way the thing is set up. Is your act of faith in the policy decisions of the Pope or his personal holiness? Not at all. And when we say the article in the Creed, I believe in one holy Catholic and apostolic Church, what I am confessing is that the holiness of the Church is on display through the sanctifying power of this institution founded by Christ,
mm-hmm.
to bring to holiness and to sanctity those members that in fact cooperate with grace. And so in every age, you get the saints. You know, Bonaventure wrote of Francis of Assisi. Bonaventure thought Francis hung the moon. We all do, right? I mean,
sure.
Francis really did hang the moon, didn't he?
I think
he
did.
Hanging up there, right?
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
It's put there. Unbelievable holiness in Francis of Assisi. Bonaventure said of him, the servant of God, that's Francis, had no one to teach him.
Wow.
You read his life of Francis.
Mm-hmm.
Servant of God had no one to teach him but Christ himself. What an astonishing admission from the future master general of the Franciscan order, Bonaventure, that there was no one in the life of Francis who stood for him as a moral example. In the so-called Age of Faith, the Middle Ages, which was also the Age of Corruption. And so our position as Catholics in the world today is no different than it's always been. I mean, Thomas Aquinas. You know, Thomas Aquinas was not well-liked in his own day outside the Dominican order. He was actually condemned by the Bishop of Paris. And he had to go and actually defend the right of the Dominicans to exist. It's kind of funny. One of the things the secular priests had against the Dominicans is that they were good preachers. And, you know, they said, Paul says, beware of people that persuade you with fancy words. Don't listen to those Dominicans. And Thomas Aquinas actually had to defend the right of the Dominicans to preach well.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they were just grasping at straws, sure, basically.
Of course.
And so your position is not different from that of the saints in every age. The object of faith is Christ. Christ is made present for us in the sacraments. And it is a dogma of the faith that we profess that the sacraments can do this efficaciously even when administered by immoral and heretical priests.
Yeah.
And so, like, if you don't have that faith, the faith that I can receive Christ in the sacraments of the church that he founded, regardless of the prudential wisdom or morality of my leaders, then it's not the Catholic faith you're professing. It's some form of Puritanism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for all the good that the papacy has done in the last 150 years in the world, it also has attained a kind of status in the moral imagination of the average Catholic that it never had previously. Right, the papacy has become a public actor, a public figure in a way it didn't used to be, so that it's, to a certain extent, it's been assimilated to the culture of political propaganda and the personality cult, right? And the media foments this impression as much as they can. You know, they cover, like, the color shoes the Pope wears on a daily basis,
sure,
and convey this sense that loyalty to the Catholic Church equates with, you know, loyalty to the policy prescriptions or the personal identity of the Pope or the bishop or the priest or whatever. And that's a misstatement of what it means to believe in the Catholic Church. And you know, that you're going to find, you're going to have, someone's going to have this difficulty no matter who the Pope is.
Sure. Some would say, keep your eyes on the prize,
which is heaven, and we get there through Christ.
Yes, indeed. Paul, thank you so much for your call. We do appreciate it. That opens up a line for you right now, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Matt is listening in Fargo, North Dakota on Real Presence Radio. Hello, Matt. What's on your mind today?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate the show. I'm a Protestant moving in the direction of Catholicism, and I really like the idea that we have the potential to become perfect, united to our Heavenly Father perfectly and be without sin on this earth. And I think that's a Catholic teaching.
It is.
Which, as you know, would be very different than my Protestant tradition. And so I've been meditating on that and trying to figure out what, in my Protestant tradition, we still want to do good works. We want to be united to Christ. We just deny that we can actually become perfect on earth here, and that somehow when we're glorified, I don't know if God snaps his fingers and then we become perfect, or how exactly that works in my tradition. But I'm trying to, as I'm meditating on this difference, wondering what benefit is it to believe that I can fulfill Jesus's commands on this earth, to be perfectly united and to be like Christ? And what, or another way to ask it is, what damage or damage to my psyche maybe has my Protestant tradition belief caused me by believing that I can't become perfect?
Thank you. I really appreciate the question. What a great question.
It is.
Well, and you're right that the doctrine of Christian perfection is a Catholic doctrine because it was taught by our Lord, who said, be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. He commands this, and God does not command the impossible. If he commands it, he has to make it possible for us to fulfill it in the life of grace.
He didn't say try to be perfect.
Exactly. He commands us to be perfect. And, you know, so there are a couple of consequences. One, if you hold the Protestant or Lutheran view, basically you're accusing God of duplicity, that God commands something that he knows is impossible in order to frustrate us. That's precisely Luther's position. God commands the impossible, knowing we'll fail, in order to make us despair. All right. And I think that Luther did that because he was simply theologizing his own neuroticism. He made normative his own experience of scrupulous neuroticism, which is a horrible way to do theology, by the way. And so it makes God duplicitous, and then we don't trust him. And then ultimately, we don't take the gospel seriously at all.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some forms of Protestantism, like radical dispensationalism, that literally think the gospels do not apply to the life of a Christian, which is just a bizarre position to take. But that's where they're drawn with this kind of thinking. Also, you don't aim for what you know is impossible. Like, I have no aspiration to be, you know, a first draft pick of the NBA.
Probably for the best.
Because, I mean, it's not, I mean, I don't particularly like basketball, but like, even if I did, it's not going to happen. You know, I'm 5'10 with a bad back and no talent. I mean, I'm not going to do it. So I'm not going to aim there. But maybe I'll get my next book done for EWTN.
That'd be nice.
You know, I think that's a realistic goal.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
And so I'm going to aim for what I know I can achieve. And God asks something of us that is naturally impossible, but not impossible to help of grace. That's Christ's, you know, with men this is impossible, but with God all things are possible. If I know that it's possible, I'll aim for what I would think otherwise would be impossible. And so it psychologically has a powerful impact. Now, how do you actually get there? Now, this is the whole realm of spiritual theology in the Catholic tradition addresses how we get there. And ultimately, you can't get there without a vigorous life of prayer. And that includes mystical prayer, contemplative prayer, and purgation from sin, and being filled with the Holy Spirit, and an illumination that radically changes the way we think about ourselves in reality. And ultimately, the union of our wills with God in charity is the path to perfect holiness. I'm going to give you some resources, and this is the heavy stuff, okay? This is the heavy stuff. The best book ever on the question of Christian perfection and the contemplation of God is a two-volume book. I mean, this will take you a year to get through, by Reginald Guérigou Lagrange, and it's called The Three Ages of the Interior Life. And it's start to finish, like, the complete picture of the Church's theology on Christian perfection as it connects to contemplation and the mystical life. Couple others that you might consider: a shorter book, Christian Perfection and Contemplation, by the same author, Guérigou Lagrange. Father Arintero, A-R-I-N-T-E-R-O, also Dominican, and it's called, I think it's The Evolution of the Spiritual Life, something to that effect, but you look up Arintero, you'll find it.
Okay.
A kind of a much simplified version, Father Dubay, Thomas Dubay's book, Fire Within.
Oh, great book.
Which is kind of a summary of the writings of Teresa of Avila and John of the Cross. Great introduction. It's, you know, much more kind of for the guy in the street. And in fact, all of Father Thomas Dubay's works treat this topic. You might look at his book on the saints, for example. I think he has a book on, I forget the titles, but he has a number of books that all treat this question of perfect sanctity. Thomas Dubay, great author, who will help you in this path as well.
Of happy memory. Well, we thank you so much for your call, Matt, and do keep listening to Real Presence Radio. It is a great companion for you there in Fargo. In a moment, we'll be talking with Gordon in Florida, who's listening online. We have a line open for you as we speak, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Called to Communion here on EWTN. Glad that you're with us. Phone lines are open right now for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, here's your chance to call, 833-288-3986. 3986. Back to the phones now for Gordon in Florida, listening online, EWTN.com. Hey, Gordon, what's on your mind today?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, go right ahead.
Okay. My question regards Vatican II. Recently, I've heard from some traditionalist Catholics that Vatican II wasn't intended to be infallible, or at the very least, not intended to be accepted by all Catholics as an act of the universal and ordinary magisterium. With that being said, can we ignore teachings of the universal and ordinary magisterium since Paul VI regarded Vatican II as such?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. I think we have a slight confusion of categories here. The Second Vatican Council did not define any dogma, which is to say it did not proclaim some teaching as divinely revealed to be held definitively by all the faithful. And that's where the charism of infallibility is most on display, in the way that, say, the first the Council of Nicaea defined the dogma of Christ's divinity. And nothing like that took place at the Second Vatican Council. Nevertheless, it's quite evident that the Second Vatican Council was the most extensive act of conciliar teaching of Catholic doctrine that has ever happened. I mean, the documents are voluminous, and some of them were promulgated as dogmatic constitutions. I mean, that's the language of the promulgation, the dogmatic constitution on the Church. Not as if it was defining a new dogma of the Church, but rather as a teaching of the dogmatic truths of the Catholic faith regarding the Church. So the Second Vatican Council most assuredly was an authoritative action of the ordinary magisterium of the Church. The extraordinary is when the Pope or the Council, together with the Pope, define a dogma solemnly. That's an extraordinary act. The ordinary magisterium is the regular teaching work of the Church. So when your priest gets up on Sunday morning and preaches a homily, he is exercising the ordinary magisterium of the Church.
Okay.
So how should we regard the activities of the ordinary magisterium? Well, it depends. It depends on how that activity is being exercised. So, for example, when your pastor preaches a homily on Sunday morning, that has some authority, but it's pretty low in the scale of authorities in the Catholic Church, right? I mean, like, it's possible for your priest to make a mistake and say something silly, and you don't have to believe him or follow him if he does, right? What if it's all of the Church Fathers in concert, all of them agreeing on a particular topic in theology or morals? That's actually infallible. The Council of Trent defined the moral consensus of the fathers as you cannot contradict the moral consensus of the fathers in the interpretation of the Catholic faith. Even though that's an exercise of the ordinary magisterium, it takes such a character that it's infallible. Right? Mm-hmm. You cannot disagree with that in their interpretation.
Okay.
What about when all of the bishops throughout the world and all the Catholic faithful concur in a dogma, in a doctrine that's never actually been formally defined? Again, infallible. Infallible. Take an example. Ordination of the male-only priesthood. It's never been defined as a dogma of the Catholic faith, but you're not going to find anything that's less controverted in Catholic history. I mean, the divinity of Christ provoked more controversy than the ordination of men only. There just is no exception to that rule in doctrine, teaching, or practice anywhere. Right, until, you know, the 1960s, right? Infallible by the ordinary magisterium of the Church. The impermissibility, the immorality of contraception, of contraceptive intercourse between spouses. Again, no dissent on this. Universal acclaim. Up until the invention of the birth control pill, basically. And it's been constantly repeated by the ordinary magisterium of the Pope and the bishops for 2,000 years, infallibly taught by the ordinary magisterium of the Church. So one of the ways that we rank order ordinary magisterial teaching is by this note of agreement. Another would be by the solemn manner of the teaching itself. An ecumenical council with better representation that from across the Catholic world than any council in the history of the Church, called by a pope and promulgated as authoritative and accepted as such, and the basis of the Church's catechetical enterprise going forward, is a pretty weighty intervention of the ordinary magisterium of the Church.
Kind of a big deal.
Yeah. Now, does that mean that we regard propositions drawn from conciliar documents as infallible? No. No, that's not the character of the thing. But does that mean you can dismiss the entire council out of hand? Not at all. I mean, the council is the expression of the Church's mind on how the faith is to be understood and taught going forward.
Okay.
I would think the work of a faithful theologian who may find difficulty with some expression of the council is then to do the hard intellectual work of trying to understand how my understanding of this may be faulty,
mm-hmm.
or how I might reconcile it with what I understand the tradition to say. You know, St. Thomas Aquinas said when faced with a contradiction, and I'm not alleging contradiction here,
yes.
I'm just stating a rule. Thomas said when faced with a contradiction, draw a distinction. Pretty good rule.
Yes, it is. Gordon, great call. Thank you for checking in with us today here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Katie's listening to us today in Atlanta, checking us out, actually listening and viewing on YouTube. Hello, Katie. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hey, thank you so much for taking my call today. This is actually my first time tuning in with you guys for an entire show, so thank you so much.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and I'm so excited. So I did have a very personal and vulnerable question for you guys. I'm 26 years old, and I have been in the Catholic Church as a convert since Easter 2016, and I have been dealing with a big issue of just sort of a lot of rejection and a lot of loneliness and the fact that I am the only Catholic in my family, and I am one of very few believers in a creator in general among my friends and among my coworkers. I'm really just alone, you know, and I'm very outnumbered by the world. And basically, the only people I really have to talk to are either in seminary or are married and have lives of their own. So what advice would you guys have for just somebody that feels like they're alone in the world? Like, I go to Mass by myself. What would you say is, you know, just the biggest advice that y'all would have in just trying to kind of just do this by yourself and, you know, just keep going pursuing the Lord, you know?
Sure.
Oh, wow. What an amazing question. I really appreciate it. And first of all, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. I mean, I kind of want to cry right now.
Yeah, me too.
Because that's such a sad place to be in life, and my heart really goes out to you. And it also goes out to you because I have young adult children that are not far from your age, and I have young adult Catholic friends in my own diocese. And yours is not a unique problem, right?
Not at all.
This is a common problem, and it's part of it is endemic to your generation, right? I mean, the culture of your peers that you've described. I mean, that is your culture. And so your decision to become Catholic is a countercultural act. Now, and so you're a witness. Of course, the Greek word for witness is martyr. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're in a sense a martyr to loneliness to profess the truth of your Catholic faith. And so one thing I'd like to encourage you with is take heart. That's heroic. That's heroic. That's the path to heroic sanctity. And we serve God by offering up our sufferings and sorrows along with our joys and prayers and works. And in doing this, perhaps you do what Paul did in Colossians 1 when he says, I make up in my own flesh what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ for the sake of his body, the Church. And you're, in one sense, you're alone. In another, you're in good company. because so many of the saints have been in your situation. Even those that lived in more pious ages have felt alone and alienated in their service of God because those around them lived a much more worldly life, even those that were nominally Catholic. You know, you've read the book of Hebrews, chapter on the heroes of the faith and those that had to hide out in caves of the ground, even as, yeah, you know, other members of people of Israel even were chasing them down to put them to death and so forth. So you're in good company. Earlier in the show, I mentioned Bonaventure, St. Bonaventure, when he wrote The Life of St. Francis. He said the servant of God, that is Francis, had no one to teach him, no one to teach him, right? And he was an outcast in his own community for quite a while. So you're in good company in that sense. Now, in terms of practically what can you do about it, I don't know if you've had occasion to look into the young adult ministries that are promoted by your diocese. I see you're calling from Atlanta, and Atlanta's got a pretty robust diocesan ministry office, and I know young adult Catholics in Atlanta, and I know that there are apostolates that are available over there. They may not be necessarily connected to your parish. It may be something that's promoted at the diocese level. So I would get on the phone and call the diocesan office and ask for the Office of Young Adult Ministry and say, you know, what is there? What's going on? And, you know, sometimes you might find circles of people that they're not going to emerge in the parish bulletins because it may be, you know, Bible studies or theology on tap or something that's taking place in another venue and you just hadn't run into it yet. And so there are young adult Catholics out there you can run around with. And they all feel just like you do.
Yeah.
You know, they all feel just like you do. And I was chuckling one time when I walked in to do radio because we had been discussing young adult ministry in my own diocese. Mm-hmm. And there were a group of the young adult Catholics that work here at EWTN gathered in the break room right outside the studio. And I stopped to speak to them and I said, like, you know, which of these ministries do you guys go to? And they chuckled and they said, well, we are the young adult Catholics of Birmingham. Like, we're working in the basement at EWTN.
We're doing it.
You know, And you know, we got some working on this show, actually. Your support staff are called to communion. So they're out there for you to find. Another thought would be, if you have not explored the religious communities, and I'm not saying you should become religious, right? Listen, hear me out. But if you haven't spent some time with the religious communities in your diocese, men's and women's communities, that's another thing to do. Sometimes I find that around monasteries and convents and friaries and priories, you know, sometimes you'll find the faithful kind of hanging around. And that's always the way it's been in the Catholic Church. You know, the Benedictine monasteries in the Middle Ages were great centers of culture and learning and trade and just good old-fashioned fun. The earliest theology on tap in history was the Benedictine monastery. They used to, you know, they would invite people in, they'd spend the night, and they'd load them up with monk-made beer. You know, and you might find some friends also, even among some of my best friends when I became Catholic were among Catholic religious. I wouldn't have thought, mm-hmm. that was the case. So there are places for you, but you got to hunt and peck a little bit. And in the meanwhile, you're living a heroic life.
Yeah.
And God will reward you.
Katie the Radical.
Right.
You know, she is. Katie, thank you so much for your call. Be not afraid. You've got that great support system right there, not far from where you are. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Now, I want to tell you for just a moment something that you really ought to consider as a big part of your own life, as it is a part of my life, and that is EWTN's National Catholic Register. What a great news source it is for you. America's most trusted Catholic news source, if I may say so myself, with a comprehensive view of the world from a distinctly Catholic perspective. And right now you can try 6 free issues with our compliments. And if you like it, you can subscribe later on. You'll get 35% off the newsstand price. What a deal that is. So to get started, visit ncregister.com today. That's ncregister.com. It's the National Catholic Register. Fantastic. Here's a text we just got from Mark today on Call to Communion. I bet you hear this a lot, David. Are Catholics even Christian?
They're Christian. They're not always very even.
Rim shot for you. Very you good.
So the followers of the way of Christ were first called Christians in Antioch. That's what the book of Acts tells us. That's the city where the word was first used to describe those who followed Christ. Who was being identified there as Christian in Antioch? Well, we can read a lot about the church in Antioch. There's quite a bit about it in the book of Acts, and as well as in other New Testament letters like St. Paul's letter to the Galatians. And it was precisely the international flavor of the group, right, that stood out, that Jew and Gentile, Greek-speaking, Syriac-speaking, mm-hmm. Aramaic-speaking, all gathered together as one in Christ, and they were conscious of being participants in a worldwide enterprise. And that's actually what Paul's writing about there in Galatians, right, that we're all, there's no slave, free, male, female, rich, poor, we're all one in Christ. And whether you live in Jerusalem or Antioch, and the third bishop of Antioch after St. Peter was Ignatius, Bishop Ignatius of Antioch. He's actually the first person to ever use the word Catholic in reference to this universal body of Christian believers. Came then out of that same community, Antioch. The word Christian, the word Catholic were used, you know, coextensively in that era because it referred to all those believers throughout the world that followed Christ. St. Ignatius also said, follow the bishop as you follow Christ. Follow the bishop as you follow Christ. In the Eucharist, which is his body and blood, this is the bond of our unity as Catholic Christians throughout the world. And so, you know, those very same apostles met in council, and they would give out rulings about, here's how those Christians throughout the world are to live their lives, and they should all follow the same practice. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians, if anyone has any other practice, has any other opinion, know that we have no other practice, nor do the churches of God. And he pointed to that universal consensus throughout the world, that Catholicity as a mark of a true follower of Jesus. So Catholicity and Christianity are coextensive, right? And it's not until centuries later you begin to have, well, you have a few little groups splitting off here and there, and of course the split-offs just multiply over time. And we can have a category now of Christianity. It's broader than Catholicism. Like, there are groups that claim to follow Jesus that are not participants in that one holy Catholic and apostolic church. But it's because they've broken off from the root and they've gone their own way.
Right.
But the church founded by Christ was the Catholic. It was that one society founded by Jesus, united in faith and governance and worship and the sacraments and the bishops, that's been in continuous existence for 2,000 years.
The original Christians.
There you go.
All right. And we do appreciate that. Mark, thanks so much for your text. It's called a communion.
It's like classic Coke and New Coke.
Oh, please. Let's not even talk about New Coke, okay? Here now is Diana in Kansas City, Missouri. She's on the Missouri side of Kansas City, listening on the EWTN app, and she's a first-time caller. Diana, what's on your mind today?
Oh, yes. Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking my call.
Sure.
I deal with the Protestants and the answers, you know, and not an apologetic like you, Dr. David Anders, but I'm doing the best I can here.
Thank you.
And I can't seem to find this answer. Okay, I was doing a study with a Protestant, and she says, we're all saints down here. We're all saints. And the only thing I could say was, because I know you say on EWTN, if we don't know the answer, just say, I don't know, I'll get back to you. Okay, so the only answer I could come up with was, no, we're not all saints. So I've looked up these scriptures. You know, it says holy ones. Some translations as holy ones or saints. But the part is, it's, you know, St. Paul and all that. I'm sure he's, you know, speaking about, you know, holy ones that live on the earth. But how do I respond to we're all saints?
Thanks. So I appreciate the question. So there is just kind of an equivocation here on the word saint. The word saint means different things in different contexts. In the sense in which sacred scripture speaks, I'm perfectly willing to concede that all baptized believers are saints in scriptural terms. St. Paul says, whoever has been baptized has clothed himself with Christ. And so we're all made holy, we're all sanctified in virtue of our baptism. Mm-hmm. Right, we participate in the holiness of the church and the holiness of Christ. In that sense, saint means holy. We're all sanctified, made holy by our baptism. So that's true. In one sense, everyone who's been baptized has clothed himself with Christ and become holy. There's another sense that we give to the word saint, and that is those who have finished the race and gone home and been admitted to glory and to the vision of God. Not everybody ends up there. Not all of the saints, in quotes, right? Not all of those who have been made holy by baptism persevere to the end and make it to that greater sanctity of heaven.
Right.
So you just have to differentiate which sense of the word you're using.
Okay. Diana, thank you so much for checking in using the EWTN app. We do appreciate that. Here now is Paul in Orlando, Florida, listening on Sirius XM 130. Hey there, Paul. What's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is regarding the time frame whenever the popes left Rome and took up residence in France. And as Catholics, you know, we have the duty to follow to accept the Bishop of Rome as our leader. And if the popes were living in France, did they continue to be Bishop of Rome? Or was there somebody else appointed as Bishop of Rome while the popes were living in France? And how did it all work out as continuing to be the head of the Catholic Church, even though, I don't know if they were considered the Bishop of Rome when they were living in France or not?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. You know how Pope John Paul II used to go snow skiing in the Italian Alps?
Oh, yes.
I'm sure you know that, right? Did he stop being the Bishop of Rome when he's on the ski slopes?
Don't think so.
What about when the Pope goes and hangs out at Castle Gandolfo, which is outside the boundaries of the city? Would he stop? Did he stop being the Bishop of Rome just because he's in Castle Gandolfo? Or when Pope Francis hops on a plane and flies to South America, or when he was in the United States, he spoke to the U.S. Congress. I think he's the first pope in history ever to come speak to the U.S. House of Representatives, wasn't he?
I think so.
Did he stop being the Bishop of Rome when he was in D.C.? No, I don't think so. He was still the Bishop of Rome, even though he was overseas at the time. And the bishops of Rome didn't cease to be bishops of Rome just because they were hanging out in Avignon. And in fact, Avignon came to be attached to the Papal States. So it was actually part of the physical patrimony of the See of Rome. They owned it, right?
Okay.
So they didn't stop being bishops of Rome just because they took a trip. Now, okay. It happened to be a very extended trip. It was like a 70-year trip.
Yeah, long trip.
Kind of an imprudent trip. And history has looked back not very smilingly on the fact that the bishops of Rome decided it was, cooler and more fun in Avignon, which it probably was, than in the hot and politically hot climate of Rome. But they didn't stop being bishops of Rome just because they were physically outside the boundaries of their see.
Okay, very good. And Paul, thank you so much for your call. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Whitaker's checking us out today on YouTube. He says, what is the church's position on marriages outside the church between two non-Catholics? Does the church regard them as valid?
Potentially they're valid, yes. So let's say two Jews get married in a synagogue, two Jewish people get married in a synagogue in front of a rabbi. That's potentially a valid, natural marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say two Buddhists get married, or two Shintos in a Shinto temple. It's potentially a valid, natural marriage. Two atheists get married in front of a justice of the peace. Potentially a valid, natural marriage. What about two Protestants, two baptized Protestants that get married in their Presbyterian church? Potentially a valid sacramental marriage.
Oh.
Because they're both baptized. Not only valid, but also potentially sacramental. Now, what about a Catholic and a Protestant who get married in a Presbyterian church? Not valid.
Mm.
Not valid, because it didn't follow canonical form to which the Catholic is obliged. What about a Catholic and a Protestant marrying in a Catholic church? Valid and sacramental. What about a Catholic and an unbaptized atheist marrying in a Catholic church? Valid, natural, but not sacramental.
Fascinating.
What about a Catholic and an atheist that get married in a Catholic church? Valid, natural marriage. And the atheist subsequently converts and is baptized. Whoops! Sacramental!
Aha! And off you go.
All right.
And we thank you for your question there, Whitaker. Thanks also for checking us out today on YouTube. A very fast-moving hour. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thanks, Tom.
We do the program Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. We also encore that same show for you the same evening at 11 p.m. Eastern, also on EWTN Radio. We give you the best of the week. Charles picks that out for us. We'll air that for you on Sundays at 2 p.m. Eastern. You can get caught up that way as well. And, of course, the podcast available anytime by going to EWTNradio.net, EWTNradio.net. On behalf of Charles Beery, Ryan Penny, and Jeff Burson, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks so much for joining us today here on EWTN Call to Communion. We'll see you tomorrow, or next time. God bless.